Hello, I am Sebastian Teotrillo.
And I'm Alex Hollingsworth.
Welcome to The Hidden Curriculum,
a podcast where we talk about all the stuff you didn't learn in graduate school. Hey everyone, hope that you had a great week. We're excited to bring you this episode today where we are learning to talk to the media. Before we get into that, I would like to know, Sebastian, what's the last thing you Googled?
The last thing I Googled. Okay, can I actually see it? I don't remember. I mean, it's something boring because it's probably something about work. Oh, it's about we're hiring this postdoc, and I just used my Google to Google like the Google Sheets postdoc that we created. So I don't know. That wasn't the fun.
Well, there you go. That's what it is, yeah. Right?
Alex, what about you?
So mine is actually, I didn't know before I did this, but it's banter questions to ask. So it's very meta, right? And this one came up in one of the lists.
That's right.
So
what about you, Fatima?
The last thing I Googled was probably I'm looking for a sofa. So
using Wayfair or were you using a different kind of website?
I've been on every website possible that can sell sofas because there are some sales right now going on because of President's Day weekend. So I'm kind of hoping that I can capitalize.
If you buy a sofa not on sale, you've done something wrong. always a sale.
My current sofa is from Big Lots, and I'm pretty happy with it. I love Big Lots. So
there you go. Sponsorship opportunity.
Okay. Yeah, sponsorship.
All right. Well, our special guest today is Fenaba Addo. Fenaba is an associate professor of public policy at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She's the Lorna Jorgensen Wendt, Associate Professor of Money Relationships and Equality, or MORE, in the School of Human Ecology's Department of Consumer Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison prior to joining UNC. Sorry, that was a mouthful. So I screwed up the past tense there. And Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Health and Society postdoctoral scholar. She received her PhD in Policy Analysis and Management from Cornell University. It seems like we're having a lot of Cornell people on here. We got a good connection there. Yeah. And holds a BS in economics from Duke University. Thank you for being here. Thank you for joining us. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me. Looking forward to it.
We are as well. So before we get into it, do you have a shareable fun fact for us?
Yeah, so I had one, but then I got reminded of something this morning from my four-year-old daughter. So I'm going to share not what I had prepared, but something new that she reminded me of this morning. So I cannot sleep without wearing socks or... and socks and having like something on me, like a blanket.
Okay.
She does not sleep with socks on. So she is fascinated by the fact that
it's a contentious issue.
Do we do this in the summer as well?
All year long. Temperature long, I need socks on. It's kind of like a comfort thing.
Right, like soothing.
Have you tried the weighted blankets at all? Is that like...
I have not. Probably, that'll be a...
They're good.
You have one, Sebastian?
I gave one to my partner as a gift, but then sometimes I like and use it, and it's I mean, obviously, it doesn't solve all your problems, right? Because like, it's meant to.
It's not a real hug.
Yeah, exactly. But when you want it, it does feel good. Highly recommend.
All right, so there you go. Another sponsorship opportunity.
We're missing so many sponsorships.
Yeah. All right. So before we dive into today's topic, we'd love to hear a little bit about a paper or a project, anything you'd love to promote.
Sure. So I guess I could say, my work, broadly speaking, examines the role of economic resources on families and households. And I've been particularly interested in the role of debt and rising wealth inequality in the lives of historically marginalized communities, in particular Black and African American households and Latinx communities. And most recently, I have done a lot of work and continue to do work on racial disparities in student loan debt and both the causes and consequences for the racial wealth inequality, especially among young adults. That was a mouthful, but
that's awesome. Very, very important.
That's where my headspace has been the last few years.
That's great. And can you quickly talk about what kind of data sets you're using for these? Because these are really interesting questions that I would be interested in knowing. Where do you get the data from?
Sure. So, ever since grad school, done most of my research with the National Longitudinal Study of Youth, the 1997 cohort. They have extensive asset and debt modules on young adults or this particular birth cohort, panel. They're a little bit older, like older millennials. So the most recently released wave, they're probably approaching 40. So they were at kind of at like the forefront of the student debt crisis, if you want to call it a crisis.
Right.
And I also work with the Survey of Consumer Finances a lot as well. Gotcha. My other work, I've worked with like the health and retirement studies. So I'm a quant person. I like panel data sets.
All right, great. So now let's dive a little bit into your workflow. We'd love it if you could share a little bit about how you approach your job on a day-to-day basis. You know, where do you put in research tasks? Where do you put in everything else? Just how do you make it all work?
I was thinking about this and how best to answer this question. I think one of the major things is whether or not I'm teaching. That will probably dictate how my week, and by, well, I should say my semester goes, but how I plan my week. So I do something called Sunday planning, which is every Sunday at some point when I get a chance. I just kind of, I still rely on paper journals and I kind of block out my classes and then my day as much as I can and try to be as specific as possible with regards to when I'm going to get writing done. I try to write in the mornings when I'm not teaching, on days that I don't teach, and then schedule meetings. This is something I've had to work on over the course of many years, but to schedule meetings on days that I teach, because teaching exhausts me so much that I can't really do writing on teaching days. So I, you know, like office hours, meeting with students and any other people that want to work with me.
And I just have a question. Like, when you mentioned the word writing, do you mean like literally like writing words for a manuscript, or is that just like any research time?
That's research time, time to my own devoted research. That's a great question, because it's I am someone who has multiple projects probably going at the same time, and I have to work usually to deadlines or conferences or R&R deadlines and stuff. So it's whatever is most pressing at the moment.
And this Sunday planning, which I really like, how long does it take you? 30 minutes, an hour? Or shorter or longer?
It's usually pretty short. So I think once you get into a rhythm and you know what you're going to do, I pull up like my Outlook on my computer, and then I have my journal, and maybe I would say about 30 minutes to an hour. It also sometimes gets conflated with me answering emails or things that I've neglected and try to get out in front of the week.
And is that also how you handle like I can see that the week to weeks, and let's say you have like a deadline within a month that you need to submit a paper for a conference or something. Is that like, how do you embed that into that weekly system?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think I'm going to try to be realistic in answering this question. I try not to think that far out. I try to think within that week, what do I need to get done? And that's probably, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but that's currently what's working for me because, that month project may not be the priority right now. I may have a deadline that's pressing for that week. And so, if I do know it's something that is going to require multiple weeks to get completed, then I'll say, okay, what can I get done this week? Like, is it read an article or, run the results again, check, do a robustness check or something like that before.
Do you like assign tasks to each day? I'm always like this. We talk about this all the time, so people are probably sick of hearing it now, but it's like, it's so hard for me to like guess how long stuff's going to take to do. So it's like,
I'm not good at that at all. It's just, honestly, it's kind of like I have, let's say like 9:30 to 11:30 on Tuesday for research. What am I going to work on in that block of time? And then once I know what I'm going to work on in that block of time, what is it that I need? What tasks do I need to address for that particular task? That's probably as specific as I get, to be honest. I haven't gotten down to the you know, the SMART goals yet. It's more,
The SMART goals when it's like a publication, because your goal is like publish this in 8 years. So, you know, it's like, I don't know. It's got to be like send it out or something. I don't know.
Right. That's
so funny. My guess is that in non-teaching semester, it looks the same, but you're just dedicating more time for research, or is there something different that happens in non-teaching semesters?
Yeah, non-teaching semesters, I've learned that I have to be a little bit more intentional about my time because I get stressed out when I feel like I'm not progressing at the same time. So I find that actually working in community is really important. And that means, you know, I guess you guys talk about this a lot. So like doing Pomodoros with friends virtually is something that
I love that. Do you have your actual friends on the webcam, or is it just like a different way?
I have done a combination of both. I've done the Zoom. I'm not a huge fan of that, but I can do it, you know, if my friends need the support I don't leave the video on. But we usually text and just say starting.
That's so cool. Okay.
Yeah.
I love
that. What are we doing? You know, setting some goals, or what are you planning? What are you working on right now? Breaking and then coming back together. So gotcha.
And did you create that or a community, or somebody brought you into that community that was already created for that system?
The main one I think that's been the longest has been just the bunch of us who started at the same time. You know, we were assistant professors. We all started at the same time, and we're trying to get something started and build community, you know, together. Yeah. So
that's neat.
Mm-hmm. One of the things is that we're actually from very different disciplines. I don't know if that's a positive or a negative, but I actually like that aspect a little bit. About it. So
yeah, that is pretty cool. I love that. And I love, for example, working in coffee shops and like seeing other people working makes me work.
Yeah.
And this time has been real terrible. So I have my roommate from grad school, James Harrison, like sometimes I texted me like, hey, work sesh. And we just like get on Zoom and do that. And now I have like a little bigger group that we're starting to do that too. Well, bigger by like 5 people. But like sometimes I need that, because otherwise, like, it's so funny how my self-control, it's like, no, you don't want to work. But the other people are working.
Like,
work.
I'm going to throw on Netflix for like 30 minutes. Yeah, it's like, ruined.
Like people need me to watch The Mandalorian, and I will watch The Mandalorian.
It is the way.
It is the way. Today, we're going to talk of the hidden curriculum topic of the talking and dealing with the media. Dun, dun, dun. And the many ways that this comes. So obviously this probably cannot be contained to a single episode, but we would love to hear tips and tricks from our guests. So maybe let's start with kind of telling us about your first media interactions and how they came about and how you felt about it.
Sure. So, you know, honestly, it's kind of hard to remember what my first few interactions were. I will say that they were tied to an early publication. It was probably when I was in graduate school. I had co-authored some pieces with some of the professors in the department, and Cornell has like did a press release. And so when there's a press release related to your research, it kind of just, you know, you don't know where it's going to go or who's going to pick it up. And several different outlets were interested. And at that time we were doing some work around marital quality and relationship tempo. So I was getting contacted by kind of like magazines and sex, family life magazines, women's magazines to talk about relationships. I think those were probably, I'm thinking that was probably one of the first.
Just quick clarification, the process of your university picking up for creating like a media press release, was that like somebody telling them to do that, or they did that on their own initiative? Like, how did that work?
If I remember correctly, you would always kind of let the department or the school know when new publications were out. So they have like a communications team or person. If they thought it was something that might be of interest to media, then you kind of, they summarize it. They summarize the article, kind of make change it to layman's terms so people can actually understand what the question was, what the main findings were. and then they send out the press release.
Got it.
So, yeah, so that's one thing that was kind of interesting. And when I shifted from Cornell moving to UW, the school that I was in didn't have like a dedicated communications team. Mm-hmm. Over time, they actually built one, but you may have to be your own press agent,
right?
If your school doesn't have some that.
We had something similar, but I've just been at one institution and we had like a change in the media team, and it went from like me feeling like, oh, this person will like help me and write these things, to now it's like, oh, I have to like write my own thing and I have to like put it into layman's terms. And it's actually been like helpful to help present it, but man, is it a lot of work to create that stuff for media people. Do you have like when you've been working with them and how do they summarize your results for the media? Did they like take stuff out or like put it, like what exactly did they do, I guess?
Yeah, the first thing that comes to mind is that they keep asking me over and over again because I can't say it in a way that is clear enough or not doesn't have academic jargon in it. So,
that's so funny.
You know, there's multiple iterations of me talking to them and then rephrasing it back to me. And I'm saying, that's not what I said. Let's try this again. That's not what I said. So, I mean, there is sometimes if time allows or time permits, emails that go back and forth, or you know, our conversation over the phone where mm-hmm. we go, you know, talk back and forth about it. I mean, if you are the one who sets the narrative, then there's a little less, you know, need to do that. And oftentimes they'll see what you wrote and then contact you and be like, is this what you found or is this what you said? So kind of asking you to confirm what you've written, what you said.
So is this your I understand this was your first experience with media. That's what we were talking about. But is this your like continued to be your preferred way of engaging with media? Or do you have like, how has your process evolved since then?
Oh, wow. So that's another great question. So that has not been the only way through print media. So I have gotten contacted both by reporters who are working on stories and they just want me to comment on there's a new data set or a new report that's going to be released by like a think tank. And they want me to comment on some of the findings because it's in an area that I've done research in. So I get a lot of those kinds of media requests. And then I also get media requests again on some, if I have a new report that comes out, a new article that comes out. One of the interesting things that has happened over time is that once a reporter interviews you or uses you in a story, they actually come back to you, especially if it's in an area of that they continue to do work in. So if it's an education reporter, if it's, you know, the family or lifestyles reporter, they'll swing back around and they'll ask, you know, do you have anything new coming out? Do you have anything that you would like for us to talk about or you think that might be, you want to get some exposure on? So you can start to actually build relationships with reporters over time.
That's cool. And that makes a lot of sense because then you can, this issue of you know, trusting what they're going to write, you know, it because it's a repeated game, then obviously they don't want to write something.
Yeah, so
one question there is, how did they started approaching you? Is it because like somebody tell them or like, I'm thinking of like the grad student who's just starting to write some stuff and maybe they don't have the support from their institution. Is there something that they can do or should they just wait?
So it's interesting. I think they're because of how, you know, large social media is and how accessible we all are these days. I've even gotten contacted, you know, because I presented at a conference. So, the reporters are everywhere and looking over if you put yourself out there, you know, it's kind of like out for public consumption. So I think one of the important pieces is, are you doing work in an area that is of current interest or, that's in the news or as a potential hot topic? That's something that you can't really predict. But if you do feel like you have an important contribution or point of view that you want to put out there, then you might need to be a little bit more intentional, right? Write an op-ed, right? Write a blog post, maybe even tweet about it. I'm not that active. I mean, on Twitter, I'm there, but I'm not that active on Twitter. But I know a lot of, you know, you can get the eye of a reporter using that as well.
In regards to establishing these relationships, I have a question that has come up a little bit on Twitter that I'm not quite sure how I feel about, and I'd love to get your take on. So I totally get helping reporters or people with questions they have about studies or things that you think fall into your area of expertise. But what I found is that I actually got a few contacts or questions from reporters where they wanted to know stuff that I think falls outside of my area of expertise. And I turned down some of those requests to do the interviews, but I've seen other people share their take where it's like, no, like maybe the next person they contact wouldn't be as qualified as you. It's like, you should still do that. Plus it's good for you to establish this relationship. I don't want to like put you too much on the spot, but like, what do you think about that? Like, what if they ask you questions about stuff? You're like, I don't really know about this area.
Yeah. So I'm with you on this. I say,
it is settled. Yeah.
So one of the things, I'll go back and then, you know, I'll say, have like your two or three points that you want to make before the interview, right? Either your findings or the points you want to make. And that is what, you know, you say when they interview you. They will always try to make you say, give some like broader implication or ask if you're saying something else. And you can say, no, that's not what I'm saying. No, I can't comment on that. That's outside my area. And oftentimes what I also will also do is recommend someone if I know someone who can speak to that area. So that also helps, you know, give someone else exposure, but also can help the reporter, because if they really are trying to answer or, you know, find someone who can speak to it, then that's super helpful for them. But I have no problem saying that I cannot speak to that, or that's something that I don't know about.
What would you say to maybe a junior scholar that is kind of just starting to get their feet wet and in talking to the media, and maybe they had a one person approaching them, and then they kind of feel like that this is somebody that they should talk to an expert on, right? And they don't consider or see themselves as an expert. And now let me talk about some personal story here where that happened to me, where they wanted me to talk about a potential implications of like the Supreme Court and the ACA. And I was like, gosh, I don't know. Like, I mean, it's not that I don't know. It's like, well, I have some ideas, but like, I just felt so unsure about myself. But then, you know, I took some time and I was like, okay, here are the things that I can say that maybe are meaningful. And I, you know, I was trying to read stuff and whatever. And then I said yes. And I think there was a shift in which I felt like I had to, I don't want to use the word courage, but like something to be like, no, I can do this. You know, I'm not like somebody who doesn't know things. I know something about this topic and I can say something. So is there I don't know, something that you would say to that kind of scholar out there, or a different way of thinking about that decision-making process?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I know exactly what you're talking about, because I think, you know, I've had those same thoughts about, you know, why me? Why, you know, do I know enough? You never know enough, but like, can I comment on it? So several things come to mind. One is, you know, you have to remind yourself why you do this work and why, and the potential for, you know, at least it's important to me for my work to reach beyond academia and reach the people that I study and you know, are in the communities that are being impacted by, you know, the policies that are happening. Yeah. So I think about that, you know, I think about where do I want my research to go? And interacting with media takes it far beyond, beyond any journal article. And then also, who do you want to have a voice in the conversation? Right. So I remember, you know, being very young and watching pundits, not saying that I'm a pundit, but like watching people on television. And those are people who people look towards as the expert in a topic, or are the people who are setting the conversation. And I think many of us in academia that's something that we want to be able to do. It is, you know, to not only contribute to, you know, building knowledge, but also be one of the voices that are contributing and contributing to the ongoing conversation. And I think, you know, like Alex said earlier, you know, if not me, then they move on to the next person.
Right.
But does the next person, will the next person bring the perspective that you have, or you know, your both the work you've done, but also who you are, right? So I'm a Black woman.
Right.
For people who don't know.
Right, that's right, because it's audio. Yeah, that's right.
So, you know, I bring a different perspective, you know, based on the identities and, you know, different in identities that I, intersect with. So, you know, a lot of the people who are the go-to experts don't look like me, haven't had the life experiences that I have. And so that's
right. And maybe people want to hear from somebody like you, even though they're telling the same kind of stuff.
And I may be saying something different, you know, and maybe that's what they need to hear. It's not something that they're going to get if they went to someone else.
Right.
Interesting. So, do you feel like you have something to contribute? Do you want someone else talking about your research? That might be another thing you need to think about as well, and interpreting it in a way that you may not necessarily want the conversation to go.
I have a couple questions about, so I've done a fair number of interviews where I'm assisting a reporter with background on a particular topic. And occasionally they've used quotes that I've had, and I think I've been accurately quoted, but in a couple instances, and it seems minor, and maybe it is minor, but I feel like the spirit of what I was trying to say is not correctly captured. And in only one case did I then email the person back, because it was about whether or not some paper was publication worthy or something. And I just, they had asked me what else would you like to see in this paper? And I was like, I don't know, A, B, and C. And then they wrote Alex Hollingsworth wants to see this done before it's published.
What a jerk.
I was like, that's not exactly the same thing, but I could see how this reporter thought that. And I wasn't trying to say the paper's bad. But when do you reach out and have pushback, or do you just kind of have to say it and then pray that it's good? I don't know.
Well, I think if you feel like you've been misquoted or, you know, misinterpreted, we live in such a, you know, a dynamic media space that if the reporter is receptive and, you know, cares about their own, you know, journalistic integrity, then they can fix that, especially if it's just an online printing. They'll just edit it, you know, if you want to get correctly quoted. So I would push back, especially if you think you've been misinterpreted or misquoted.
And I guess on that, I thought what was really interesting is when you said, when you, once your research is out there, people might interpret it in different ways than you intended or thought of. I was wondering if you could expand a little bit more on that. I've definitely experienced that in my own case. Someone wrote an op-ed, and part of the thing that they linked to was one of my papers being we shouldn't have lockdowns for COVID. And I was like, whoa, I agree. When unemployment increases, people might do more drugs, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't have lockdowns.
Right.
At the same time, they weren't it's not crazy to be thinking about those
using that as a
trade-offs,
right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's one of the other sides of doing and putting your work out there, is that it may be misinterpreted. And I think it is up to you to decide how much time and much energy you want to devote to dispelling, you know, those, you know, that misinformation. Sometimes it may be worth it. I mean, to kind of either write a response op-ed, or I was misinterpreted, or get on Twitter and, you know, try to see how much of a reach that can happen. But sometimes it may really not, you know, again, depending on the magnitude of the issue or, you know, the misinformation, it may not necessarily be worth it to respond. I've taken probably the latter approach about, you know, especially when you do work on contentious topics such as race and racism within the United States, I often get people who are, I get responses from the public, mm-hmm. Who have misinterpreted what I've said. So,
this is something that I think you both touch on, but let me ask another question, and it's a question for both of you. So how do you you get a request, how do you decide whether you want to take it or not? Like, what are your kind of like set of criteria that you both use when somebody asks you about something?
The first one is if I'm available. So one of the things,
right, time.
I'm sure Alex is well aware of is that reporters work on very tight deadlines. And so usually if they contact you, they're like, I'm trying to finish this article by this afternoon. Maybe next 2 hours.
Oh, it's like that.
Something really fast. It can be really fast. So if I am available, and you know, they'll say, I need 10 minutes, 15 minutes to respond. So that's probably the
right. First criteria.
The main drive. Yeah, the first criteria. And then if it's in an area of that I know something or I can comment on, if I feel comfortable talking with them, and if it's from a media outlet that I know.
Assuming it's on a topic that I have some expertise on, I have pretty much always said yes. I have occasionally, because I am slow at email, and there were periods of my life where I was like days before I was like getting to parts of my inbox, totally missed a request from a reporter who was on a deadline. But I've typically responded. I don't get a ton of media requests or anything. It was it's like one or two papers that I seem to get requests on. But sort of to answer your one question about like what are some like unknown outlets, I have this one paper on like vaping and marijuana, and I had got requests from people from like weird, maybe they're not weird, but like weird names I would never heard of that are like websites like some marijuanatimes.org or something, and like but they were like legitimately interested and had like read the paper, so
that's funny.
For the most part, communicated with all of them,
right?
But I clearly had never heard of those outlets before.
The dudenews.org, right? Yeah.
Yeah. That one I would obviously get priority. So.
Got
is that a thing?
dudenews.org.
I'm afraid to Google it.
No, please don't do it. That's awesome. So let me take a little pause here and say that I think in this conversation, I noticed that, for example, some benefits of approaching the media and talking to the media is that your work is going to get out there. And that's important, especially if you consider your work to be important for policy relevance. There's also the benefit of having your own particular voice, and maybe that's attached to an identity that it's good to have in that conversation. There's some drawbacks, obviously, depending on your time and depending on the experience that reporter or person that you contacted in. Is there anything else there, for example, that I think you guys mentioned that maybe I'm missing from the drawbacks and benefits part?
I guess one thing I will say a drawback is, I guess we kind of also spoke to it, but you may not always be able to control the narrative, right?
Right.
So that, it is someone else who is going to ultimately interpret the work.
Right.
And so you have to be okay with that. Mm-hmm. One of the ways that you can is if you do live interviews. So, I've done some radio interviews, and those have been fun. I haven't done many, but I've done a few. And I always have enjoyed doing them, and even doing kind of like call-in shows where people call in and ask me questions.
Oh, about cool.
Or the topics. So those have been really great. I think oftentimes people just want to provide their story or the perspective on the topic. You get that especially a lot with around people's individuals.
More of a comment than a question.
Yeah, a comment than a question. A comment than a question. Exactly.
I have sort of unrelated to this topic, but a question I wanted to ask you earlier that I just don't want to like lose before we wrap up. So you publish a lot in sociology journals, and I think they have a similar time lag from like when you produce a working paper to when like the paper has page numbers and is published. This has been a thing that's kind of come up in, at least with me and with other economists that I know, that like the paper is like mostly done like 3 or 4 years before it has page numbers. Often, if you get rejected a lot, it's been a working paper online. It maybe even has like citations. How do you think about media and relation when in this world of working papers with this large time lag, or how does that change how we should approach things?
Yeah, so I would say that the time lag is long, but it's definitely not as long as econ. I know econ has gotten better, but the timeline isn't as long. And usually when sociological articles are made public, it's as close to publication or has already been accepted and is just working its way through the last stages of the publication process. So that's, I think, one of the main differences is that, you know, it's already gone through the peer review process when it's been open for public consumption. There has been a growing movement within sociology to kind of increase the working paper series, embrace that similar practice, but it's been slow. So if you see a paper that is a working paper or has been published, it's probably been already gone through the peer review process.
I see. Mm-hmm. So I guess I just to clarify, sure. What you're saying is that when you're begin the process of like media attention on a paper, it's typically accepted or conditionally accepted at a journal, and it's yes. not often before okay. that.
That is probably more than not the case. That it's
but would you feel comfortable doing that with a working paper that has not been accepted or something or somewhere? Or at that point, you
would? I would personally not.
Okay, that's good to know.
I don't necessarily judge people who feel Got fine it. putting it out there. I think that's just how I was raised, how I was trained.
Right. How I was trained. That's funny. Another question that I had again, before we maybe go to the summary in another mm-hmm. section is, did you receive any training and was that training helpful?
Sat through several trainings. So my postdoc offered a few
okay.
Through the Robert Wood Johnson mm-hmm. Foundation. We had a few working with the media, and also we had modules on what they call knowledge transfer. So how do you get your work, you know, in wow. an accessible form for public consumption or for, mm-hmm. you know, for the mm-hmm. media. So I have had, you know,
yeah.
at points throughout my training, some.
And were those helpful, you think, or, you know, there's a couple of things you can let us know from what you learned there?
Yeah, so I guess I would say that I've never really shied away, if you look at, I guess, my CV, on trying to do like non-peer-reviewed kinds of writing. So I've written reports, I've written blog posts, and I always find that I'm not good at it, but as I do that, I'm working through it and trying to get
right.
better at it. So if this is something that you are interested in or are interested in doing, I think taking those opportunities, and giving yourself an opportunity to kind of try that kind of writing helps.
Right. Builds the confidence too, probably.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So that's what I would say is don't shy away from opportunities mm-hmm. that may be outside of your, you know,
right.
Your comfort mm-hmm. and try to embrace them because you only can work to get better. And then also I would say partner with somebody who is very good at it, you know, who has the experience. Because mm-hmm. I'll write something and I'll think that this is great. And then I hand it over to them and they're like, oh, no. I will say one of the things that I'm still working towards or trying to be better at is, you know, as researchers, we tend to like bury the lead. And, you know, because I want you to be excited at the end when I do the big reveal. But they're, you know, media doesn't have time for that.
They want to know. Leave it the lead.
Completely opposite. Hey, leave it the lead. There you go.
I think one of the big takeaways that I had that I think was at least new to me is like, think about working with reporters and media in general as establishing relationships. Mm-hmm. So you can offer insights about your own work, but also about other work and other related things. And that might help you in the long run, but it certainly helps push forward the narrative and just information disposal in general. Also, it's okay to say no, but if you do say no, like a referee report, try to suggest somebody else. Yeah. But if you do know something about that subject matter, you know, get out there and tell people about it. To have an impact, you have to reach people. People don't read journals. If we're lucky, they'll read the news or watch TV about the news, but that's your best chance. And you got to think, you know, do you want your voice in that conversation? When you're talking with the media, I think this sort of was, we were talking around this the whole time, but, you know, be clear and concise and, you know, don't use the fancy words specific to your field. Like try to understand, like, what's the main point? How can I explain this to somebody clearly?
So that last point, if you can, sometimes ask the reporter for questions in advance so you can actually prepare.
Great. That's a good tip.
That's a very good tip. Yeah. Now you're not thrown off guard. Like, I have no idea. Like, that's what you maybe do.
You can practice.
Great. Thank you so much for those insights. Every week, we like to ask our guests for a recommendation of the week. This could be anything, a podcast, a quote, a command, a recipe, a book, a song, anything that improves your life. What would you like to share with the listeners today?
Sure. So I'm teaching this semester, and one thing, I'm teaching remote synchronously. So I meet my students twice a week.
You're doing a live TV show, essentially.
TV show. And I've so this is not my own like invention, but I've had other people recommend it, and I'm doing it the first time this semester, which is I'm starting each class with a song, and I'm trying to connect it to the topic.
Oh, that's hard.
or even something that's going on, you know, in the world or during that time. And I love it. It's been like the best. Both fun trying to find songs. Like, I've got my partner looking for music. I've got my sister looking for music. I'm like, I'm about to teach this. Can you give me a song? And then I tell them, you know, we're in the process, we're creating a playlist. So it's been so much fun.
So what's been your like number one hit so far?
Oh, so I think the students really liked when I played War by Bob Marley. they were commenting, and then it got into a conversation in chat about what was his best song, or you know, what is their favorite song.
People love those questions.
So that was a fun day when I played that song.
I endorse his recommendation. I also do it too, and I throughout the year create a playlist of like songs that I want to play in the beginning. So that's awesome.
Okay,
You guys Alex, are like Peloton instructors or something. Like this one's gonna get you pumped up for today. Exactly. This one, is boring because today's boring.
Yeah, there's one that you know, I have the tiger right before the exam to get them pumped. Alex, what is your recommendation of the week?
All right. So I've been doing like, obviously the worst part of the publication process is revisions, just because you're like mentally done with the paper. And I find that like, I am so prone to typos when I'm mentally done. Like after I've done all the new analyses and everything, and I'm just trying to incorporate the new text in. I don't know. I can't seem to get myself to do it. So I've also, I normally would like go to a colleague's office, but could you like read this page? And I can't do that now. So I'm making my computer read things to me, and it's great. So I turned on, I have a Mac, and I turn on the accessibility, it's like select, like read selected text or something. And so now whenever I hit a keyboard combination on my keyboard, it'll read the highlighted text, and it's like robotic, and it's not perfect, but I caught a lot of typos I don't think I would have caught otherwise.
That's so awesome. That's a really good idea. Yeah.
Is that through Word or is it through the Mac?
I think it's a Mac thing that like will read text that appears somewhere on your screen. I presume something similar exists on PCs. But,
it does. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Accessibility. Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
It's super robotic, but it works.
The identification is strategy.
And then if it's like justified and it's on like the next line, I'll be like the identification. Yeah. Right. It's like, oh, okay. Was that a typo? Like, no, you just couldn't read right.
That's awesome. My recommendation of the week is going to be a book. The book is called The Public Professor, How to Use Your Research to Change the World. This is by M.V. Lee Badgett. So I'll put the book in the show notes, but it's a really cool book and talks about like their experience of the author with how to make the research, you know, fit into policy. It's a little bit of a different take, but I like it. I'm going to recommend it. Also, thank you so much for being here with us today. If people want to find out more about you and your work, where should they go?
Google me. It'll probably be the only Fenobarbital that will come up. And you'll get to my my webpage at UNC. I also have an old website floating around there. But you can also find me on Twitter.
Also put it in the show notes. Great. That's all we have for you folks today. Make sure you subscribe and leave us a review. Let your friends know about this podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Bye.
Thanks, everybody. Awesome.
All right.
Thanks, guys.